Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We're going to talk Emmys with Neil Justin, bottom of the hour. But one of the stories that's getting some play locally is Let's Go Crazy. And the fact it was tied to a Capital One ad. And it was aired last night, including even before the Emmys with one of the pregame shows. The point that Prince would never, ever have accepted this, the public believes. As the Tribune story points out, Londell McMillan was criticized for some of the deals he made on behalf of the state, took to Twitter to voice his discontent with this commercial. The story points out that licensing decisions such as this commercial are left up to the former Spotify and record company executive hired by Comerica to manage Prince's estate, Troy Carter. It's very possible the singer's family had little input in the decision. However, family members continue to rack up millions of dollars in attorney's fees, and they still face a massive estate tax. As the story points out, there are numerous people who are ticked about this. The Riemenschneider wrote this. Does it surprise you, Adam, that we're seeing this? Because it doesn't surprise me at all.
And it's kind of, to me, it's...
We've had this debate many times, haven't we?
Yeah, and every sports team in town plays Let's Go Crazy now. I mean,
It's way overplayed. Okay, I agree. I still love the song, but I get the initial intent, and they're trying to still capitalize on it. The Twins are still having Prince days.
They're still releasing music. We have a story today about more music.
Music's coming out.
Do I think the song would be commercialized if Prince were still alive? No, but he's not. And
I'm going to say probably not. It's funny the transformation some people financially make later in life. There's, let's be clear, zero indication that earlier or throughout the majority of his life, he would have ever done this. We just don't know what would have happened. But this litigation has been going on for multiple years now. I think you at one point claimed that you were Prince's cousin. I mean, we had like 97,000 people who did. Boy, I'm sure these lawyers are working for cheap, aren't they? So there is an extraordinary amount of cost. So I don't think this is the last time we're going to see it. But as you said, you think when you're at every other sporting event and it's played, it hasn't moved beyond kind of that line where so many different songs have moved for a financial or capitalizing or trying to monetize themselves. Yeah, sadly, that happened a long time ago. Back to the Kavanaugh conversation in moments. Right now, an update from Adam Carter. We right now are trading phone calls with Aaron Blake from the Washington Post, who covers politics for the Post. And we want to talk to him about everything that's taking place with Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford. This story that did or did not start 40 or 35 some years ago. We know the story by now if you've been paying attention. Blasey Ford sent a letter to her congresswoman, and eventually that was turned over to Dianne Feinstein and held on to for a period of time. Republicans are suspicious of that. The Senate and her staff says they did that to protect the anonymous nature. She then steps forward in a Washington Post story. And now the story has grown bigger and bigger. Brett Kavanaugh has adamantly denied it. The other individual in the room has adamantly denied it. He has said he is willing to testify, Judge Kavanaugh. We thought at one point yesterday she had agreed. That was erroneous because right now she has not agreed. Democrats are saying it should be more than just his version and her version. They believe the FBI should investigate this. Others are saying, mainly Republicans who are supporting Judge Kavanaugh, they're saying, now, wait a second. We've already had the FBI vet Kavanaugh 6 different times. This is just a delay tactic. The latest is, in the last hour or so, that senators have said to representatives who are representing Blasey Ford that she can do this either publicly or privately. So Aaron Blake from the Post is good enough to join us. Aaron, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much. Do you have any idea? Yeah, no problem at all. Do you have any idea when you think we'll get a timeline on whether Blasey Ford will testify Monday and whether it will be publicly or privately? Or is it just this story is just happening right in front of our eyes and to project that is too difficult?
Yeah, so her lawyer has put out word that she is willing to testify. My suspicion here, and I can't say this with authority, is that this is negotiating details of other people who might be present to testify, how that testimony will look. Usually this process is not just about, you know, we're willing to show up. Okay, do you want to come and they hold a hearing. There's a lot that goes into this, and especially for somebody like Ms. Ford, Dr. Ford, who is clearly hesitant to come forward. I think that her lawyer would be wise to negotiate many things. So I think that the understanding is still that she expects to testify. There just may be a little bit of things to get through before we get to that point.
The president was just speaking with the leader of Poland, and the surprise of no one, he was asked about this. And the president reiterated that the claims should be investigated and said verbatim, shouldn't be even a little doubt. Do you think Republicans are cringing a little bit because of the president's words are taken and they're extrapolated a little bit, Aaron? If he's saying there shouldn't even be a little doubt, then he's kind of playing to what the Democrats are saying, isn't he, that there should be a full investigation of this, and that potentially could take more time than just having, as we just were discussing, who's going to testify on Monday.
Right. That sentence is the most unhelpful thing that Trump has said all week about this, probably the most unhelpful thing any Republican has said this week about it, because it does suggest that this needs to be resolved completely, whereas that's going to be a very difficult thing to have either way. This is something that happened allegedly 35 years ago. It's not a situation in which there are easy answers. And Republicans want to get this confirmation done because they could lose the Senate. This is their chance to control the Supreme Court. And they're not going to get that resolution anytime soon. So I would expect the White House to walk that back pretty quickly and say the president was just speaking off the cuff and didn't exactly mean that it needed to be definitive proof necessarily.
He also added he feels bad for Kavanaugh. He doesn't deserve this. For the folks who say, what sort of investigation can take place? This was 35 years ago. This involves, if you believe what the doctor is saying, 3 individuals in a room, 2 very drunk. What can be done at this point? She, according to the reporting so far and according to what you said to your paper, didn't make any mention of this until 2012 in therapy. So the belief is that no one else knows about this. What can an investigation discern at this point?
Well, it's difficult, and obviously the FBI has chosen not to investigate this any further. Basically, what you can do is try and square everybody's version of events, try and figure out what other people who are at the party might say about this. There isn't a readily available conclusion here. But I think what we're going to see at, you know, in the testimony on Monday, assuming that actually moves forward, is something like we'd see in that investigation, albeit more cursory, which is basically getting everybody's version of events out there and letting people decide for themselves who they think is the most credible. And that may not, you know, the legal standard isn't going to apply in that situation. It's going to be a political standard instead. But that's really all the better you can do unless the FBI were to take this case up.
You had Jeff Flake, who is leaving, who is a Republican, who has been an ardent critic of the president, say yesterday that if a hearing wasn't scheduled, if that this vote would have stayed on plan for this Thursday, he would have voted no. So now he's a little more up in the air. Before, in the months leading up to the hearings, it was all about Collins and Murkowski. Are we looking at those three? Are we looking at anybody else who might be looking to potentially alter their decision pending what does happen Wednesday, what does happen Monday, if Monday does take place?
You're exactly right about those three. Those are the three big ones. If I were to add one to that list, it would be Senator Bob Corker, who is also retiring like Jeff Flake, has also been quite critical of the president at times and has expressed, along with Jeff Flake, some reservations about pushing through the Kavanaugh nomination. That's an important point, though, here. Republicans in another scenario could, you know, potentially force this thing through, but they have their own members who need to be convinced here. They're not trying to get Democrats on board. They're trying to get Jeff Flake and Susan Collins on board.
Yep.
And so that's why they're trying to handle this gently. They're saying there should be a process here. And at least until a few minutes ago, when the president basically cast doubt upon these allegations and said he felt bad for Kavanaugh, they've done a pretty good job of saying they're going to let this process move forward.
One of your colleagues in the Washington Post today, Deanna Paul, wrote about, you know, sex crimes prosecutors and how they've analyzed previous cases and looking at what Dr. Ford wrote. And I thought it was interesting that one of the individuals who spoke out said this: to me, it's compelling that Ford put someone else there, that the person who happens in the room has a blackout drinking problem. This is Judge, Mark Judge, who wrote the book. That sort of intoxicated behavior she described that night. Ford mentions the details like the pool party, the narrow staircase, that house. There are enough facts for someone to remember it was their party and it was their house. Aaron, I think it could be interesting when people are trying to decide, and there's going to be so much of this right on Monday, who's more likely telling the truth right now, where it is where she may provide very precise details. And in other areas, she says she doesn't remember, because you can find just as many individuals who are going to say, listen, if you go something this dramatic, and it is 35 years ago, it is realistic to say you're not going to remember every single part.
Yeah, and I think that's what this, you know, people like to talk about how this is a he said, she said. That's not exactly accurate here. What we're talking about is a version of events in which she's provided a number of details. He has provided a denial, a couple of denials, actually. And those can be checked against what other people who were there have
right.
said about it and yep. will say about it. But as of this point, I would point out, nobody else besides the two of them are slated to testify on Monday.
Yep.
The Senate Judiciary Committee is not calling on Mark Judge to testify publicly. Mark Judge, who is allegedly an eyewitness to what happened here. And those are things that would seem to shed some light on whose version is more believable. And I think the fact that Republicans aren't calling them, I think, is a difficult position for them to try and hold up at this point.
Aaron Blake for The Washington Post is with us. I know Dianne Feinstein has been receiving criticism from Republicans on the timing of this, saying that if this letter was sent to her in July, why did it come out now? I know, among others, Senator Chris Coons from Delaware came out today and said part of the reason why she was trying to protect the privacy, protect her anonymity, and that the events of the last few days caused that to change. Does that explanation hold up to you, or is some of what the Republicans are saying about the timing of this seem fair?
I think there's a reason that has been the biggest argument against this accusation, the biggest defense here, because it does suggest that there could be a political element to this. It would be a last-ditch effort after the confirmation hearings, but before the voting actually started. But there's also, you know, the argument that Coons made and that Feinstein, I would add, has also put forward is a very plausible one. If you look at how sexual assault accusers and victims generally talk about these things. It is a very difficult thing to come forward with. A lot of times it's easier if there are other people who are coming forward with similar stories. Maybe this woman was waiting to see if other women would come forward and it wouldn't just have to be her delivering this story. The timing is not ideal for anybody because this is so late in the process, especially because Republicans want to get this done very quickly. But here we are, and it's something that has to be contended with in some way. Even Republicans acknowledge that. Nothing is ideal about it from either side. But in politics, things tend to happen on their own schedules, and that's certainly what's happened here. And as I said before, there is a perfectly plausible explanation for this not having come up before, whether or not you think that's actually what happened.
Right. For people to act like that everybody just steps forward and everybody just talks right away and there isn't trauma and sometimes you don't have therapy involved in incidents, well, you're just clueless. Now, whether it happened 100% in this case, we don't know, Aaron, right? And I'm sure Republicans are going to say if she doesn't testify Monday when they've asked her, whether it's publicly or privately, they're going to say, okay, what else can we do then? We got to vote.
Yeah, I would think if she doesn't wind up testifying, it would be difficult to draw this out anymore. She's obviously given her account. The fact that she's given an indication that she would testify, if she were to back out of it, I'm not sure that, Kavanaugh would not effectively be able to confront his accuser. It would be a difficult situation for Democrats to argue that this should continue in any way. But you never know. You never know exactly what's going to come about with this. As I said, I would still lean towards expecting her to testify on Monday, given she's expressed a desire to do so.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. Well, I'll continue to follow your reporting. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Aaron Blake, good reporter, Washington Post. Absolutely a good follow. Keep checking what he is doing. Let's pause right here on CCO. Neil Justin on the Emmys in a matter of moments. Let's get back to the Keith Ellison story. I'll say again, personally, I will not vote for Keith Ellison until I hear more from him about what took place. His explanations are not enough to me. He sat down with Esme Murphy. He answered a few other questions, and he says nobody's asking him about it. But then when we've asked him to come on this show 6-7 times, no response. When others have tried to get him to answer, no response. There are very important issues that will decide the attorney general's race. But when accusations of abuse are made about him in the manner, he should answer those questions. And he continues to avoid them. And you had the individual, Karen Monahan, who has raised the idea of an assault of a video of what people knew, and that's how the story went out. Now, I raised at the time, too, if you're going to bring the video up, and the son did, and that added for a lot of people the potential credibility of the story. It wouldn't have ended without a video, but it added more. And then all of a sudden there are different words or different explanations where the video went. I think that's a fair story also. But Karen Monahan tweeted out some comments yesterday when she's asked, Democrats say they believe women, in this case, the doctor, and the accusations about Kavanaugh, do they believe you, Karen Monahan? No, they don't. I've been smeared, threatened, isolated from my own party. I provided medical records from 2017, stayed in two different doctor's visits. I told them about the abuse, who did it. My therapist released records stating I've been dealing and healing from the abuse. Four people, including my supervisors at the time, stated that I came to them and shared the exact same story. I shared publicly. I shared multiple texts between me and Keith where I discussed the abuse with him and much more. As I said before, I knew I wouldn't be believed. I didn't break my silence for validation or any outcome. I did it for my own internal freedom to stand with other survivors. I have nothing to prove to anyone. I simply shared my story. People can believe it or not. I don't need anyone to affirm my humanity. I affirmed it. I don't know if she's telling the truth. I don't know if Keith Ellison's telling the truth. Just like I've said the same thing here with the doctor and Judge Kavanaugh. But when you raise this, and when you're the individual, when it's raised about you, and you're running for an important position like the Attorney General, and yes, voters will have an opportunity, or when you're becoming potentially a Supreme Court justice for 30 years, to me, it's on you to answer some questions at length. And it may be difficult. It may be complicated. It may be embarrassing. But if you're putting yourself out in those positions, and I get it, because there are a lot of people who look at me too, and part of them look at it and say, it is fantastic that we have this, that women and men, but let's be honest, still it is more women, feel more empowered to step forward and they're heard. And the authorities are paying more attention. Their colleagues are paying more attention. Men are paying more attention. And others will say, now, wait a second. Somebody comes out with an allegation and too many people automatically default to, well, it's got to be true. I'm not defaulting either way. That's why I said in the Kavanaugh and with the doctor, I want to see an investigation of some level. And with the Ellison situation and Karen Monahan, among other things, I still think Keith Ellison has not answered enough questions. And when the DFL is saying our investigation is going on, what does that mean? Give us a little more depth to that answer. It's 34 past 2. The Emmys took place last night. Let's talk about it right now with our favorite that we talked to regarding television, the Star Tribune's Neil Justin. Always a pleasure, sir. The trend continued for award shows where the numbers dropped again. This is now the lowest rated Emmys ever. What do you think the story is behind that?
I think we all watch in smaller pockets than we used to. That's one of the reasons broadcast network TV is not the player it used to be when it was. These shows that would win awards would be seen by 25, 30 million people. Now, the shows that win, a Mrs. Maisel or an Atlanta, may be only seen by 8 or 10 million people.
Yep.
So there's less people that are watching. In some ways, this has created better television because programmers don't feel that they need to fill a big tent. But it's harder to attract an audience that going to go crazy nuts for a show they have in common. We're seeing this problem with the Oscars as well.
Yep.
And which is why they temporarily suggested that we have a film category for most popular film. Well,
thankfully
that was
they came
silly.
To their senses. Yeah.
Yeah, and they came to their senses. So I think it's just an ongoing. You know, this is the way it's going to be, and maybe these award ceremonies aren't as big a deal as they once were. It still pulled a nice number for NBC.
Yeah, right.
But it's not the must-see television that it may have been 10 years ago.
Early on, you touted and told me, and have continued to tell me a number of times, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is a great show. I have not watched it yet. That's on me. It's available. What makes it so good to you? Were you surprised by the number of awards the show won last night?
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. I thought Atlanta would do better, but as I've said since the beginning of that show, great show, deserving of an Emmy for Best Drama. It is got about as many jokes in it as Game of Thrones does.
Yeah,
it is a fantastic series, very inventive, but it's not necessarily a comedy. It's 30 minutes long, and I guess that's what makes it a comedy. Maisel is a much more traditional comedy winner, and what thrilled me was that it finally gave some credit to Amy Sherman Palladino, who also created Gilmore Girls, which I know is your favorite show.
I watch it each night.
I know you've modeled much of your personal life on that program. I know you and your dad have very much the same relationship that the Gilmore Girls have with each other.
Very similar, yeah.
Yeah, but so never recognized before, and the fact that she won three awards last night, that show got some attention, thrilled me. But certainly I felt bad for Atlanta. It was a chance for some history to be made.
Right.
I think one season of The Cosby Show is the only other time a best comedy series with a predominantly black cast has ever won that Emmy. And who knows, they might have taken that Emmy away from Old Bill.
Right. It's sad that we're still, I mean, in 2018 that we're still at that number is embarrassing.
Yeah. So, you know, the fact that it was completely shut out was a bit of a surprise. I thought Donald Glover would at least repeat his best actor. Bill Hader got it for Barry, which is an okay show, and props to him. We knew Henry Winkler was going to win, and that was a very sweet moment. Again, a guy who'd never won before.
Did he? Was that a lifetime deal? Do you think that was?
That was a lifetime deal. You know, Louis Anderson got kind of the same deal a couple years ago. And that's okay with me. You know, very likable guy like Louis is. Been at the business a long time. Have to explain to kids who the Fonz is. But that's okay. Maybe it'll get some younger generations to look back at his earlier work. But overall, I thought there were a lot of fresh faces and a lot of Better Late Than Never awards. I thought it was a real nice mix.
So let me stay with the Atlanta topic. We are seeing more of these type of shows, Neil. You know this better than me, where they don't just automatically fit drama. They don't automatically fit comedy. And we, you know, so should the Emmys accommodate for that a little bit? Or are they just going to continue to stay, here's our limited series, here's our comedies, here's our dramas, and that's it, we're not moving?
It's a good question. I think maybe we do take down those barriers. You know, sometimes I wonder if these awards we should be giving out, Best Actor and Best Actress. I'm a member of the TV Critics Association. We don't separate by gender. You know, you're either the best performer or you're not, regardless of gender. Maybe it should be divided by age. I mean, you know, or length of show. I mean, I'm not a big fan of changing things just to change things, as we learned from the Oscars experiment with that, or temporarily one. That can be dangerous. But I do think there's some merit in taking another look at how we define what's a comedy and what's a drama.
What did you think of Colin Jost and Michael Che and as the host and how they were used, how they dealt with, well, they weren't quite in the opening because Hollywood was kind of, TV was poking fun at itself and that they had solved the diversity, you know, all diversity has been resolved now. But those two individuals who are the writers behind SNL, the faces behind Weekend Update, how they played.
Well, I think the whole show was an SNL production, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was, 100%.
It. There was so, I mean, it became almost laughable how many SNL characters people showed up, and in fact the
too much for me
was presented by Kenan Thompson.
I love you, Kenan, but come on.
That's a pretty high prestigious position, and it was just all SNL people, which I mean, it kept the show moving. There were some funny bits. I laughed a lot when Will Ferrell came out, and there were some other funny bits, so that's fine. But it put Che and Jost kind of in their SNL roles as kind of, you know, coming in and being a little more stoic, perhaps, than they might have been without the rest of the cast around. But that was fine. I mean, it's not necessarily wrong with an SNL Emmy night, you know, it felt a little bit weird. But I thought they did fine. I thought the monologue was good. And they kept the show moving. That musical number at the beginning wasn't great.
No.
But it wasn't, you know.
It was fine.
It was fine.
Yeah.
I mean, I have no major complaints about the presentation itself, nor am I going to put it in for a Peabody Award.
No, I still think SNL is great. I just thought it was too much. What I know you're a sentimentalist. I know at times that you'll cry watching TV.
That's
and you're
true.
Not afraid to admit it. Were you grabbing the tissue when the proposal took place?
Well, that was my idea.
Oh,
yeah.
Wait, you're gonna propose on TV, and then they pushed you, or what was your idea?
As you know, I'm very, very, very good friends with Jimmy Kimmel and all the people that are associated with.
Hold on
a
second.
We play
let me
poker
give
online. And you know, they called and said, what can we do to spice up the show?
Yes.
The guy who did that and that woman don't even know each other. That woman was hired from a casting agency.
Sure.
And but it's gotten some good pop. I feel very proud of it. And I'd like to keep it to myself, which shouldn't be a problem because I'm telling it on your show.
I could see that joke coming down the lane. All right, let's get to the only reason that the Emmys were a victory last night, that the most underappreciated show of the last multiple decades finally, outside of a great supporting cast member, Margot Martindale, who won a couple Emmys before, who played like the de facto link between the KGB and the two individuals living here in D.C. But the folks, the creative genius behind it for the writing of the final episode, and then Matthew Rhys. So this is Matthew Rhys and Carrie Russell, and they are the Russians who are sent to D.C., and they live their whole lives there. They have kids there. And for 6 years, the whole thing is, can they continue to do this? Can they continue to, you know, stop Americans, kill Americans, live their life when their best pal is the head of the FBI, or not the head of the FBI, but an FBI agent living right next door? And it was an interesting year, Neil, because we talked about this before. The Carrie Russell was much more out front for most of the last season. She was still there. She was physically struggling. But I thought as the year went along, the kind of the internal angst of Matthew Rhys was phenomenal. And yeah, I'm biased because I absolutely love the show. But I thought the series finale and the now fantastic parking garage scene where Matthew Rhys is just amazing won him the Emmy that he won last night.
Yeah, I think Carrie was in a tougher category.
I do too. Yep.
And that category could have gone a number of different ways. In fact, on my kind of cheat sheet, Claire Foy was fourth on my list of possible winners on there. So that was kind of bowled me over. I think I made a joke on Twitter that that was a Vikings kicker worthy performance on my part, because that's how far off I was on that category. So in a very, very difficult category. But as fans like you know, Matthew and Carrie are real life couples. So they'll get to keep that Emmy. They'll share it at least until they split up, which will probably be in a year.
But
it was one of those shows that, and that was a nice thing about last night. There was recognition across the board, in some cases, for shows that, or people that have been overlooked. And they did it with Amy Sherman-Palladino. They did it with Alex Borenstein, who was just one of my favorite people in Hollywood. They did it with Henry Winkler. And of course, as excited as you were about the Americans' win, I could hear the scream from your house.
Yes.
The only louder scream I heard from your abode was when RuPaul's Drag Race. Hello?
Yeah. I'm here.
I know that you never miss an episode.
No.
And
I have friends
that
over.
That actually was a big win because the category has been dominated by the Amazing Race.
Right. Something different.
It was something different. And actually ended up being one of the few wins for diversities in the diversity category. But, you know, it's nice that they won should they have won Best Drama?
Yes.
Possibly. Well, yes, you would think so.
Mm-hmm.
But notice how the show that I was really behind did win.
Yeah.
And the show that you were really behind did not.
Okay, on that note, we're going to let Neil go. I mean, seriously. I mean, you're right. But, you stay with the Hollywood elites. I'll stay with the masses here in the Midwest.
I think everybody would agree to that.
Thank you. Neil Justin from the Star Tribune. Yeah, it's just last thing, because I know we got to go. If you wait years and years for a scene to finally happen, as we did with the Americans after 6 years, and it lived up to it, and one actor is remarkable, then he should be richly get the award that he did last night. Check out Matthew Rhys and the Americans, still available to you. Twins in Detroit, so we're off tomorrow. Then conversations all about healthcare on Thursday from 9 to 6, so please listen. Linda's construction time check is 2:57. Time to make your home energy efficient with Season Guard windows. Paul and Jordana are next. Enjoy the afternoon.